You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll hear about a small-town Wisconsin news reporter and his collection of quirky stories that ranged from his observations about the Spanish-American War to who in town grew the best watermelon.
First, Donald Trump received an unwelcome embrace today from the official paper of the Ku Klux Klan, the KKK's quarterly newspaper, which describes itself as the premier voice of the white resistance, printed a full-page spread with the headline, Make America Great Again. Trump's campaign rejected the de facto endorsement today and called the publication repulsive. He also said it does not represent the people uniting behind Trump's campaign.
Backing from white supremacist and nationalist groups has been a problem that the Trump campaign has struggled with. Brian Levin joins us now. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, and a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice. Brian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, give us some historical context for this, if you would. Has the KKK endorsed a mainstream candidate in recent history?
You know, I'm trying to think. I know that George Wallace, when he was running for governor of Alabama, initially did not receive the Klan endorsement and said he was not going to be out N-worded again, and then sought their endorsement for a subsequent successful run, for instance. Certainly Strom Thurmond, for instance, when he was running for president in decades prior to that. We saw some support from hate groups for Pat Buchanan, but when, for instance, Larry Pratt, his national campaign co-chair, shared a stage with Aryan Nations in 96, he was promptly let go. So what's interesting is that here, it's not just the Klan. There's almost complete unanimity among the extremists that I track in their support for Mr. Trump and his candidacy.
Do you consider what this newspaper has done, this KKK newspaper, an endorsement?
Well, let's put it this way. Tom Robb is someone who never got in the way of getting his name mentioned in the media. He's a longtime Klansman based out of Arkansas. He even came down during the Rodney King trials to protest in support of the police that were on trial. So if there's a media circus, he's attracted to it like flies on flypaper.
I guess another question is, does it matter if it's an endorsement or not? Is it one and the same?
Well, I mean, the thing is, I mean, and this is extraordinary, and I'm not someone who likes to participate in political discussions. Last time around, for instance, when I was on Hardball with Chris Matthews, he said, who do these hate groups like? Is it John McCain? Is it Ted Cruz? I said, no, they're all part of the system. They don't like it. I think what appeals to these extremist groups is not only the fact that there's messages about Euro-nationalism and prejudice that seem to permeate out of this campaign, but also that it's an insurgent campaign against the Republican Party. So one of the things about the alt-right that I think is very interesting, a lot of people will rightfully look at it in the Euro-nationalist lens and the racism that's there, but it's also a movement that's about insurgency and destroying the traditional Republican Party, which they're doing a pretty good job of.
We're talking with Brian Levin right now, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino. And he's with us now to talk about the KKK's embrace of Donald Trump on the front page of its official newspaper. And early on, Donald Trump came under fire for not immediately disavowing support from David Duke in a conversation with CNN's Jake Tapper in February. Here's a clip of that.
Even if you don't know about their endorsement, there are these groups and individuals endorsing you. Would you just say unequivocally you condemn them and you don't want their support?
Well, I have to look at the group. I mean, I don't know what group you're talking about. You wouldn't want me to condemn a group that I know nothing about. I have to look. If you would send me a list of the groups, I will do research on them. And certainly I would disavow if I thought there was something wrong. But you may have groups in there that are totally fine, and it would be very unfair. So give me a list of the groups, and I'll let you know.
Okay. I mean, I'm just talking about David Duke and the Ku Klux Klan here, but
I don't know. Honestly, I don't know David Duke. I don't believe I've ever met him. I'm pretty sure I didn't meet him. And I just don't know anything about him.
Well, and since then, Donald Trump has repeatedly disavowed Duke and has been exasperated that he had been asked to do that repeatedly. And he's also blamed a faulty earpiece during that interview that he says didn't allow him to hear questions clearly. So given that exchange and what's happened since, was that backlash against Trump overblown?
No, I think the New York Times had a great quote, and they said, Mr. Trump's failure to distance himself more sharply from white power adherents has been minutely observed in online discussion forums, and I've been writing about this in the Huffington Post for some time. It was alarming from the beginning how this support really gelled, and it gelled fairly early. So we really have a virtual, I don't want to call them an all-star team, but an all-star team of extremists who support the Trump candidacy. So, for instance, the American Renaissance Jared Taylor wrote, and this is in 2015, Donald Trump may be the last hope for a president who would be good for white people. And we're seeing the Daily Stormer, Stormfront, David Duke, the Ku Klux Klan, and a variety of others giving full-barreled support. We're seeing robocalls being done by white supremacists on behalf of Mr. Trump. I am not saying that he's organized this, but what's interesting is from time to time he will say things that are dog whistle signals to the extremist racist right. And let me give you some examples. When he talked about the 1965 Immigration Act, well, that was the one that stopped discriminating against non-whites, for instance. And when he talked about having immigration go back to traditional patterns, that's basically a dog whistle message of white people. So this talk about banning Muslims, also retweets of racist, bogus statistics about black and white crime, which completely misstate it, the use of Pepe the Frog that's retweeted, and a whole bunch of things just keep coming up. And it's really interesting. There was a recent study that showed out of 10,000 Trump supporters, 3,500 had some internet connections to hardcore racist tweeters. And that's scary.
The Trump campaign quickly called the publication, that KK newspaper backing article, called it repulsive, said it's not representative of Trump supporters. Isn't that an example of turning away from the KKK's backing?
Yes, except they don't believe it. You know, when they love the fact that it took until like the last week of the campaign for some kind of thorough disassociation. By example, President Reagan, who launched his White House bid in Philadelphia, Mississippi, of all places, when he got a Klan endorsement, immediately and vociferously and unequivocally criticized it.
I want to jump in. You're saying that these hate groups don't believe the disavowal. That's what you're saying.
No, not at all. I interview these people. I go to their rallies. No, they really like Donald Trump. And one of the things that we see, for instance, is when he did an event in Alabama, there were white power slogans that were yelled. Matt Heimbach, who is a bigot, who's head of the Traditionalist Workers Party, an anti-black racist group, he manhandled an African-American female protester at a Trump rally. So this is very disturbing. One of the things that we saw in our study recently was that when Mr. Trump made his statement about banning Muslims, hate crimes went up 87.5% in the next 5 days off of an already elevated number following the San Bernardino terrorist attack. So we're very concerned that words do matter. And we're also very concerned about some of the anti-Semitism that has come out, that has particularly been directed at journalists who have been covering his campaign.
Now, there's a question out there lingering that some of the fringe views of the alt-right, maybe nationalist views or racist belief systems, could be folded into mainstream politics. Do you think that that's a possibility?
It's happened. And unfortunately, this is not a development that started with Mr. Trump, by the way, nor is it something that even is just indigenous to the United States. We're seeing this throughout Europe, this Euro-nationalism, and this bigotry is something that has taken hold in other countries, and we're seeing it here. What I think is noteworthy about Mr. Trump, and by the way, I'm not calling him a racist, and we're nonpartisan, and we don't do endorsements, but here's what I think is interesting. He is someone that the racist right has been looking for, an iconoclast who wanted to destroy that wall that folks like George W. Bush and John McCain and Bob Dole and Orrin Hatch did with regard to overt bigotry. They criticized it. In this case, this is someone who, with a wink and a nod, appears to embrace it. And what they have is something they hadn't had before, and that is a celebrity charismatic spokesperson to galvanize a movement which was somewhat splintered and without leadership. And again, I'm not calling him a white supremacist, but that has been the effect. And we're going to see this effect going after the election as well.
Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, and a professor in the Department of Criminal Justice. He joined us there to talk about the KKK's embrace of Donald Trump on the front page of its official newspaper. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about a small-town Wisconsin news reporter and his collection of quirky stories from over a century ago.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
The Brewers may have had a losing record this year, but it wasn't always this way. Historian John Gerdo recalls his lifelong love of baseball and the 1957 season that defined a baseball-loving childhood.
The Milwaukee Brewers weren't in it this year, again. When the World Series began, our boys of summer were home with the rest of us, watching teams with better bats and bigger payrolls compete for the title. Milwaukee wasn't always in rebuilding mode. We went to the series in 1982, at the height of the Yount Molitor era, and our team won the whole thing in 1957. Those of us who recall that triumph have gray hair, if we have hair at all, but the 57 series remains a defining memory of our childhoods. Milwaukee's team then was not the Brewers, but the Braves.
And the Milwaukee Braves take to the field.
They had arrived from Boston in 1953 and promptly won the city's heart. After decades in the minors, Milwaukee moved up to the big leagues overnight, and the players were greeted with an adulation that bordered on adoration. The team set a National League attendance record in its very first season, inspiring such excitement that one sports writer called Milwaukee County Stadium an insane asylum with bases. I was one of the inmates on occasion, with four small kids and a tight budget. My parents weren't inclined to spend money on baseball, but Aunt Johnny was. At least once each summer, my mother's older sister would take the train down from La Crosse during a Braves homestand. While my folks relaxed on South 34th Street, this intrepid former nurse would take all four of us out to the ballgame. Peanuts and Cracker Jacks, soda and pretzels, everything was possible with Aunt Johnny. Snacks were so rare in our house that my brother Mike once took home an empty peanut bag as a souvenir. Night games were especially memorable. We'd pray through the dim recesses of County Stadium and emerge to a view of the field so bright it was almost psychedelic. The grass was impossibly green, the white foul lines so vivid they almost vibrated. This, I thought, is what heaven must look like. For the rest of the season, a little gold and white transistor radio was my primary link with the Braves. Night after night, in the room I shared with my two brothers, I'd fall asleep to the sound of Earl Gillespie and Blaine Walsh doing the play-by-play. During the 1957 World Series, everyone listened. Our team faced the New York Yankees, setting up a showdown between big city might and small city right. Milwaukee had always followed the Braves with rabid interest, but we were absolutely memorized in October of 1957. At my grade school, St. Mary's in Hills Corners, classes were actually canceled during every day game. We all trooped down to the lunchroom to watch the action on the biggest black and white TV the nuns could find. It took seven games, but the Braves prevailed. Lou Burdette, whose number 33 adorned my Little League uniform, was the MVP, pitching three complete games against the Yankees, including two shutouts, and posting an impossible 0.67 earned run average. Pandemonium reigned on the streets of downtown Milwaukee, and even in the quiet cul-de-sacs of Hales Corners. The memories are indelible, but they seem impossibly distant to us aging baby boomers. When will glory descend again? Rebuild if you must, Milwaukee Brewers, but please, don't take too long.
John Gerda is an award-winning historian and the author of many books, including his most recent, Milwaukee, City of Neighborhoods. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, Freeland Dexter was a news reporter from the small Wisconsin town of Lone Rock from 1884 to 1912. As a correspondent there, he reported on everything from the tragic to the amusing.
His great-granddaughter, Deanna Haney, has curated his collection of stories in the new book, The News from Lone Rock, Observations and Witticisms of a Small Town Newsman. And she joins us now. Deanna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, when did you start that you were going to start decide you were going to start looking back at these columns of your grandfather's and bringing them together?
Well, I was doing genealogy work for my parents and my grandparents, and I came upon his obituary, and that's what started it.
Did it surprise you? Was this stuff you didn't know about him?
I didn't know about it at all, no. It just said he was a newspaper man, and I didn't know even what town. So I was looking in Lone Rock in Richland Center because he lived in Richland County, and then in Spring Green, and then I found it at Spring Green here.
How hard was it to get a handle on some of these past columns and actually be able to read them?
Actually, it was very easy. Once I found the town, the right town, I went to the Spring Green Library and started going through microfilm, and I went through over 1,500 pages.
What struck you about these old columns as you started to read them, these columns from your grandfather?
Well, some were dull and boring, and the rest were just off the wall. Some of them were really, really funny, and some were very, very sad. And it just amazed me that he could paint a picture of Lone Rock as it was in that time period. And he had such a way of speaking. It was very interesting.
And there's a connection made in the book between Mark Twain around the same era of history, living along the Mississippi River, writing, observing the small things about life and the way people are, and your great-grandfather writing in Lone Rock. What do you see as the connection between the two?
My brother-in-law wrote that foreword for the book, and I thought it was very nice that he compared the two. It's just that Freeland was just as witty as Mark Twain could be sometimes.
Do you have a favorite moment of wit in these columns?
There's a lot of favorites. I often wondered where my dad's sense of humor came from. He had kind of that dry sense of humor. And I decided I finally knew after I read Freeland's writings, because Freeland would come up with the funniest things every once in a while. I would be sitting in the library, you know, it would be very quiet, and I'd be going through, and all of a sudden he'd say something really funny, and I'd just burst out laughing because I couldn't help it.
Nice. That was but a way of getting to know your great-grandfather that you couldn't have otherwise. What did it feel like?
It felt like I knew him, even though, of course, I've never met him, and my grandmother never talked about him to me, so I really didn't know that much about him at all.
And these columns, it seems like they're also a time capsule, in a sense, of what Lone Rock was like then and what life was like at the turn of the century. What sort of picture did he paint of what that small town was like?
It was very interesting in that he described a busier Lone Rock than what I ever knew when I was growing up. They had a lot more buildings and a lot more stores and different things like that, and he just described all their get-togethers and their things that they would meet each other at different houses and have different kinds of socials, and it was just very interesting to me. And the other part was the train was a big, big factor. The train schedule, or the trains were set up that every 7 miles they had to have a railroad stop because they needed water. And so that's why Arena had one, Lone Rock had one, and Blue River had one, Muscadet had one. I mean, you can just follow the train tracks right down the line. And I didn't know there were so many accidents on the train that he talked about. So many runaways with the horses, which I never, ever even thought twice about.
And were there people in the book that kind of emerged as characters?
Oh, yes. Foster Brewing Company was one. Mr. Foster was also working in the general store, but he owned the Broom Company, and he would put out flyers and postcards, and he would mail I don't know how many of them, and he even sold brooms overseas. He even sold to Wales, of all places. And he was very big on the brooms, and this is something Lone Rock isn't today. Lone Rock is a pretty quiet, basically just quiet town now, but at that time it was just booming.
And I understand he really did look at some of the little things as well, including who grew the biggest watermelon. What was it like reading just fun columns like that?
Well, it just made me laugh. I mean, it sounded like something that my dad would have said, but he would come across something. I know one thing that's not in the book, because excuse me, my book had to be cut down a little bit. I had a lot more pages to it. But one of the things that didn't make it in was a one-liner. He talked about a dog being on the railroad tracks and a person on one side of the track calling him, trying to call him off because his train was coming, and one on the other side of the track doing the same thing, and so the dog just stayed in the middle and got hit by the train. But then he said that dog, it cut off all four of his legs, but then he said that dog is bound to be crippled for life. And, I mean, something like that, it's just like, that dry humor came out during a tragedy.
Right, and he covered, you know, tragic things. I know he wrote about the deaths of children, and he really was a chronicler of life in Lone Rock. Do you think that he's remembered by that community?
Hardly anybody there knows of him. I mean, everybody has gone on, moved, not had any children in that area anymore. There's a few people that know him, and that's about it.
What is your hopes for what this book will do for your great-grandfather and his writing?
I just hope that others would enjoy it as much as I enjoyed putting it together. I never knew that much about the time period, and I just thought people would like to read about it.
Deanna, thank you so much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That was Deanna Haney. She's the editor of the new book, The News from Lone Rock, Observations and Witticisms of a Small Town Newsman. We've been talking about stories and reporting from her great-grandfather, Freeland Dexter.
Coming up, we'll look at the proposals from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton about how to fix America's Social Security system. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight, Halloween is done, but Snap Judgment still has some scary stories to tell. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, Social Security has been called the third rail of American politics for a long time now. In other words, a warning to politicians, don't touch it. Today, Social Security does have some problems. By many estimates, unless changes are made to Social Security law, the program will only pay 75% of scheduled benefits by the year 2035.
That's what most people agree on. What's still up in the air is the best way to fix it. The two major party presidential candidates have different approaches, as do various public policy groups.
Bridget Madrian joins us now. She's a professor of public policy and corporate management at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. Bridget, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you.
Well, I want to start with talking about how this problem is framed. And this came up in the third presidential debate. I want to listen to a little bit about how moderator Chris Wallace framed the Social Security question.
Now, the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget has looked at both of your plans, and they say neither of you has a serious plan that is going to solve the fact that Medicare is going to run out of money in the 2020s, Social Security is going to run out of money in the 2030s, and at that time, recipients are going to take huge cuts in their benefits.
So Social Security running out of money in the 2030s, huge cuts in benefits. Is that an accurate portrayal of what's going on with Social Security?
Yes, that's an accurate portrayal if nothing is changed. So under the program as it currently exists, in 2034, all of the trust fund balances will have been spent, and Social Security under current law is constrained to only pay out benefits that would be equal to the tax revenue that is being collected. So if the benefits are not cut and the revenue is not increased, then the benefits that the Social Security Administration will be able to pay will be about 75% of what workers have been promised.
We'll get into some possible specific changes to Social Security and what the candidates are saying about it. But first, big picture, you're describing an outcome that I think nobody wants to see happen, but a lot of people have different opinions on what to do. Is the political will there to make significant changes that are going to change that scenario?
Well, that's a good question. I would say that from my standpoint, Social Security has been surprisingly absent from the political debate, at least among the presidential candidates. You led with the question by Chris Wallace on Social Security, and I think what is so remarkable about that question is that it was the very last question in the third debate. So it was snuck in at the end and, you know, barely discussed in all three of the presidential debates, and really hasn't been a focus of much of the discussion on the campaign trail either, at least in terms of what the media is covering. So it doesn't seem to be really high on the policy agenda. The way policy is often done in Washington is it takes a crisis in order for something to happen. And it's hard to motivate, strong support for change today for a problem that many perceive as not being a problem until 2034. But of course, the real problem is that if we wait until 2034, it's a big problem. But if we do something today, it's much less painful to address it, 20 years in advance.
We're talking about the future of Social Security and the present of Social Security policy with Bridget Madrian from Harvard University. Let's make the most of that debate moment and hear a little bit of what each of the candidates had to say when asked what would you do, in effect, about Social Security and Medicare in that question. Here's, first of all, Donald Trump, part of his response.
I'm cutting taxes. We're going to grow the economy. It's going to grow at a record rate.
But that's not going to help on entitlement.
It's going to totally help you. And one thing we have to do, repeal and replace the disaster known as Obamacare. It's destroying our country. It's destroying our businesses, our small business, and our big businesses.
So the rest of his answer there focused on the Affordable Care Act. But as he hinted at the outset, he says that his tax plan will grow the economy. That economic growth is going to help fund Social Security. Can you explain what he and his campaign have said and whether that is plausible?
I think most economists think that that is not a very plausible solution to the problem. So, first of all, the evidence that cutting taxes will grow the economy is controversial. Reagan cut taxes, promised that we would get economic growth in the 1980s, and I think in retrospect, those promises were probably somewhat overblown. So not everyone agrees with that particular tenet. And while growing the economy does lots of wonderful things, that in and of itself is not going to solve the Social Security problems, because if wages go up, the benefits to which workers entitled will go up as well. So there are more fundamental problems with the system that need to be addressed.
But the idea that a high enough rate of growth, I think economists have said, if you could sustain a 4% rate of growth, that might bring enough new money into the Social Security trust fund to stave off that 2034 deadline. Is there anything to that?
Well, I mean, we haven't had long-term sustained 4% growth, for a long time. Even if you got 4% growth for a few years, you know, we have economic cycles. We do well, and then we have a recession, and then we do well, and then we have a recession. So I think it's completely unrealistic to assume that we're going to enter a period of sustained 4% a year growth, if that's what it would take to you know, solve the problems in the system.
All right, let's get to Hillary Clinton's answer to that same question in the third debate.
Well, Chris, I am on record as saying that we need to put more money into the Social Security Trust Fund. That's part of my commitment to raise taxes on the wealthy. My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out how to get out of it. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure that we have sufficient resources. And that will come from either raising the cap and or finding other ways to get more money into it. I will not cut benefits. I want to enhance benefits for low-income workers and for women who have been disadvantaged by the current Social Security system.
So no cuts to benefits, she's saying. Maybe an increase to benefits for people who don't, she says, get enough out of the system. We'll do that in part by bringing in more money from wealthy people, in part by raising the caps on Social Security contributions. Talk about the impact of that, please, Bridget.
Well, if she wants to increase benefits, she will definitely have to increase taxes. And if she wants to, you know, not have to cut benefits in 2034, so increase both the promised benefits and then make sure that you can pay the benefits that have actually been promised, then you would have to have, you know, a non-negligible increase in taxes. I haven't run the numbers for her plan, but you know, you would have to both increase the Social Security payroll tax rate, and you would have to increase the maximum earnings threshold at which earnings are subject to the Social Security tax.
We're talking to Bridget Madrian. She's a professor of public policy and corporate management at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She's with us to talk about the future of Social Security and what Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump's plans might accomplish when it comes to fixing it.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you have questions about the future of Social Security? Who do you think has the best plan about how to fix it, how to make sure it's solvent? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Harvard University's Bridget Madrian is with us now. We're talking about the future of Social Security and who's got the best ideas about how to fix it.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about the future of Social Security and the policies needed to extend its lifespan. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Bridget, before we go to our callers, what would you like to see? What kind of plan would help really make a difference in Social Security?
Great question. I spent the last 2 years serving on a commission convened by the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the 19 of us who were on that commission spent 2 years coming up with a set of recommendations to make Social Security solvent and also increase the capacity of Americans throughout the income distribution to save for retirement, to supplement their Social Security income. And what we recommend at the end of the day is something that most of the economists that I know who have thought carefully about Social Security generally recommend as well, which is a combination of increasing tax rates, either the payroll tax rate and or the threshold at which payroll taxes are collected, a slight cut in benefits, and that cut in benefits should be done in a way that is having a bigger impact on those who would get the most benefits in the first place, the wealthiest individuals in the economy, and could be done without cutting benefits for people at the low end of the income distribution at all. So slight increase in taxes, slight decrease in benefits, and then increase the normal retirement age so that it is pegged to inflation. So in our in the Bipartisan Policy Commission report, we recommend increasing the retirement age by 1 month every 2 years. So it would go up an additional 2 years from 62 to 69 over the next 40 years, which we think is, you know, well in line with expected increases in longevity that we've been experiencing for the past century at least. And the Social Security benefits reforms that we propose would actually increase the benefits going to the lowest income Social Security recipients. So the people who need it the most would not have their benefits cut. They would actually have their benefits go up a little bit. Some higher income individuals who can afford a cut in benefits would get a slight decrease in their benefits, but the benefits they would get as a result of the reform proposal are higher than what they would get if the system is insolvent in 2034 and everyone's benefits are cut across the board. So, you know, we think that our proposal can be framed as a win-win. If we do something to solve the problems in the system now, we can make sure that everyone is getting more than they would get if the system goes insolvent in 2034 with a slight increase in taxes today.
And Bridget, I want to bring in a caller now. Brian is with us in Prairie du Chien. Brian, hi.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I heard your interviewee talk about the threshold. She hadn't run the numbers for Ms. Clinton's plan, but what kind of revenues would be raised if the earnings cap was removed and high earners paid on every dollar like most low-income workers do in our economy?
So I don't have a ready answer to your exact question. For the Bipartisan Policy Center recommendation, we had to increase the earnings threshold from where it is today to a little bit below 200,000. So that's not removing it entirely, but it is increasing it quite substantially. And our estimate was that increase in the maximum taxable earnings limit in combination with a 1% increase in the payroll tax rate phased in over the next 10 years and a few other minor changes would be sufficient along with the benefits restructuring to make the system sustainable for the long-term future going forward. So it not only gets us past 2034, but it gets us in a position where, at least for the projections we did, going out at least 75 years, the revenue coming in is sufficient to pay the benefits that are promised. So if you increase the earnings cap, or if you eliminated it completely, you would obviously get even more revenue, but I'm not sure exactly how much more because I haven't run those numbers.
Brian, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Paul in Hiles. Paul, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring
Hello.
Up, Paul?
Just doing a little fact-checking. I've heard over the years that various administrations dating back maybe 30 years have taken a total of somewhere around $2 trillion out of the trust funds. A, is that true? And B, can we get it back?
Paul, thanks for that call. Briefly, Bridget, have we been, in effect, raiding the trust fund for the federal budget?
Well, the accounting for Social Security is complicated. So, you know, the way it works is in the past when contributions have exceeded the payments that Social Security needed to make to beneficiaries, it was never the case that the money was, you know, put in a giant, put underneath a giant mattress stored somewhere in Washington. It was effectively lent to the federal government and used to finance other government programs, the rest of the government then has a debt obligation to the Social Security system. And so that when Social Security needed to draw down the trust fund, they're, collecting that revenue essentially through higher other taxes today to make up the difference. So can we get the money back? Well, yes, but the only way to get the money back is by raising taxes. So you can either raise Social Security taxes or you can raise income taxes. But, the reality is the only way to get the money back is by raising taxes.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Bridget Madrian, professor of public policy and corporate management at Harvard University. She joined us to talk about the future of Social Security.
A Marine Corps captain is running as a Republican for the 8th District's open congressional seat. Mike Gallagher has both a combat and academic background. He's running to fill the seat being vacated by incumbent Republican Reid Ribble. Patty Murray has this, our second of two profiles on the candidates in that race.
Mike Gallagher is 32 years old and has never held elected office. That didn't keep him from beating two opponents in the August primary. He frequently mentions his military service on the campaign trail, telling a crowd of supporters on primary night that he was ready for his next mission.
I am asking you to deploy me into enemy-occupied territory.
Gallagher served two combat missions in Iraq and rose to the rank of captain. He left the Corps in 2013 and went on to work in Washington as an advisor and then as an advisor for Governor Scott Walker's failed presidential bid. That's how he met incumbent Reid Ribble, who gave Gallagher a primary endorsement. Ribble says he was almost immediately impressed.
I met with him and I remember walking away thinking, wow, for such a young man, he's really, really smart. That was kind of my gut reaction to him. At that point, I didn't know that he had two master's degrees and a PhD, but it was pretty evident that he was a highly educated guy.
Gallagher's PhD is in international relations, but he says his true passion and expertise is in early Cold War history. He spent months at the Eisenhower and Truman presidential libraries doing research for a 500-page dissertation. Gallagher called it
Changing Course, the Sources of Strategic Adjustment.
Chants of I Like Mike break out at rallies, channeling the 1950s slogan used by Ike Eisenhower. Gallagher's ready to talk Cold War anytime, even at an informal campaign event recently in Green Bay.
That period where we really built the national security community in order to deal with the long-term threat posed by the Soviet Union from 1947 onward has always fascinated me, and how men of good faith on both sides of the aisle came together to confront an urgent threat, and we're sort of operating under or using some of the same structures today that were built back then. And I think time has long passed for us to have a similar reassessment and look back at some of the threats we're facing.
Gallagher's not all scholar, even though in his off time he says he reads history books. He also plays guitar and likes to socialize with friends and family. His political role model is Abraham Lincoln. Gallagher says he's always admired the warrior scholar model.
I think you need a balance, right? You know, in the Marine Corps they teach you have to exert physical leadership, moral leadership, as well as academic and intellectual leadership, and you have to be balanced on all of those. And so I've tried to do the same in my own approach to leadership. But yes, I'm a nerd, Patty. Thank you for reminding me.
If he is a nerd, Gallagher's supporters, like outgoing Representative Reid Ribble, don't seem to mind.
I don't have any dirt on them all, and I've been trying because I'm really competitive. So I can't find a flaw in this guy, so it bothers me.
When Ribble was elected, he self-imposed a term limit. He's leaving Congress after serving 6 years. Gallagher won't make a similar promise and gives every indication he's eager to enter Congress, even though he calls it a deployment and not a career path. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can follow the results of that election and everything else going on in Wisconsin around the nation with election night coverage here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Programming starts at 6 o'clock with a special from On Point, then special coverage from NPR. And then starting at 8, as the polls close in Wisconsin, we will have live coverage with analysis and results from around Wisconsin provided by Wisconsin Public Radio's news team and live coverage from NPR's news team looking at the race for president, races for Senate around the country, and control of both houses of Congress. That's election night coverage. You'll find it here on WPR. Stream it, WPR.org, or use the WPR app on your smartphone or tablet.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.